Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale, Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namane, Namaste Saraswati Deve, Gauravani Pacharane, Nirvase Sisanyavadi Paskatya De Satarane, Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavam Sha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitam Sha Panchakalpa Trupascha Kripa Sundaviya Vatapati Tanam Pavanevio Vaishnavavya Namavya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So it is March 12th, 2022, 26 Second Avenue, and we're studying the Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 3, Text 28, and can you allow me to share my screen, please?
Yes, now allowed.
All right. So I can sing and then please stay muted, but you can repeat. Tattva vittu mahabaho guna karma vibhagayo guna guneshu vartanta iti madvana sajyate. Once more. Tattva vittu mahabaho guna karma vibhagayo guna guneshu vartanta iti madvana sajyate. Tattvavit, the knower of the absolute truth. Two, but Mahabaho, O mighty armed one, guna karma of works under material influence, vibhagayoho, differences, gunaha, senses, guneshu, in sense gratification, vartante, are being engaged, iti, thus, matva, thinking, na, never, sajjate, becomes attached. Srila Prabhupada's translation. One who is in knowledge of the absolute truth, O mighty armed, does not engage himself in the senses and sense gratification, knowing well the differences between work in devotion and work for fruitive results. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The knower of the absolute truth is convinced of his awkward position in material association. He knows that he is part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna and that his position should not be in the material creation. He knows his real identity as part and parcel of the Supreme, who is eternal bliss and knowledge, and he realizes that somehow or other he is entrapped in the material conception of life. In his pure state of existence, he is meant to dovetail his activities in devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna. He therefore engages himself in the activities of Krishna consciousness and becomes naturally unattached to the activities of the material senses, which are all circumstantial and temporary. He knows that his material condition of life is under the supreme control of the Lord. Consequently, he is not disturbed by all kinds of material reactions, which he considers to be the mercy of the Lord. According to Srimad Bhagavatam, one who knows the Absolute Truth in three different features, namely Brahman, Paramatma, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is called Tattvavit, for he knows also his own factual position in relationship with the Supreme. Tattvavit tu Mahabaho Guna Karma Bibhagayo Guna Guneshu Vartanta Iti Matvana Sajjate. One who is in knowledge of the Absolute Truth, O Mighty Armed, does not engage himself in the senses and sense gratification, knowing well the differences between work in devotion and work for fruitive results. So this verse is very much talking about what is matter and what is spirit, what is entangling and what is liberating. Later in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that somebody whose consciousness is in sattva, sat means that which is true, that which is real, that which exists, knows what is binding and what is liberating, what is to be done and what is not to be done. So imagine if we could know that, right? If we think about all the decisions that we make in our lives, you know, what to do, what not to do, what will be binding, what will be liberating, what will be a happy situation for us, what will be a difficult situation for us. If we could understand that, what a benediction that would be, to know what is binding, what is liberating, what is material, and what is spiritual. So we're going to look at what is spiritual and what is material, and then we're going to look at how to live. What is the ultimate way to live? So what is spiritual? Well, here, tattvavit. Tattva means truth. Vit means to know. One who is tattvavit, one who knows truth. And Srila Prabhupada, in this purport, is quoting from the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, that one who knows the truth knows it at Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So let's look at each of these, and then we'll also consider another way of understanding the Supreme Truth. So Brahman means the Absolute Truth as simply being. I remember when I first joined the Hare Krishna movement in the 70s, there was a very popular book, which I did not read, called Be Here Now. But that is very much what the Brahman is. It's being here now. It's just being. It's just peace. I was just reading, a former student of mine recently recovered from a 2-month coma, and she said that when she was in this coma, she found herself, her consciousness, in this very beautiful place full of flowers that had no sounds, but she could hear peace. And she just felt peace. She just felt loved, and she just felt peace. So that the very Brahman is something like that. Just this feeling of greatness. Brahman means greatness. And this is one manifestation, one form of the Supreme. Now, there are those who think that this is the only manifestation of the Supreme, the oneness, where there's very little distinction between, or very little sense of a distinction between one being and another, and between the individual beings and God. So individuality is not really experienced. I mean, it's there. It's not that it's not there, but it's not so much experienced. I mean, we have some situations in our ordinary life where we really feel so close to someone that we feel almost as if we're the same person. You know, they have a saying, one soul in two bodies. And so sometimes people feel this to some extent in our embodied life. But this is an absolute sense of that, that I am you and you are me, we are all one with God, and we are just being in peace. And it's certainly a very happy, a very joyful, very blissful situation. There's just love and there's just peace. But there's no activities, there's no form. There's not really relationship, because there's just a sense of everybody being everybody and everybody just being. Now, this form of the Supreme pervades everything. All the cosmic universes are existing within this beingness, this Brahman. Then there's a more personal manifestation of the Absolute. And that is the form, again, we have a lot of religionists and spiritualists who understand this form to be the only form. And that is the form of God the Creator, God the Maintainer, the Witness, the Judge, the Neutral Party. So God is a person, but his personality is not so manifest. One could think of it that just like a person goes to a job, and in their job, they're certainly an individual person, but they're not manifesting, they're not showing, they're not exhibiting all of the aspects of their personality that they show with their intimate family members and their intimate friends. You just see a little slice of them, and you see the official slice of them. You know, maybe you only see them in a business suit, you know, doing business, and maybe they talk about their family very little. You know, oh, how's your husband doing? How's your wife doing? Oh yeah, she's great. How are the kids? But not much. You know, you may know very little. You may know little or nothing about the home life of your coworkers, or what to speak of if you go into a business, right? You go into a shop, or you go to a doctor's office. Yesterday I took a friend to the doctor's office. And there was the doctor and the doctor's assistant and the nurse and the receptionist. And, you know, all you barely know is their names, right? You don't know anything about their family. You don't know anything about their life. You know very, very little about their personality. I mean, one of the women who at the reception desk, it was very clear to me, was wearing a wig. And so you're wondering, why does she wear a wig? Did she have cancer and she had chemotherapy and she lost all her hair? Does she just not like the way her hair looks? Does she just like to wear wigs? Who knows? It could be 100,000 different reasons. So, you know, all you're seeing is the official person. So this Paramatma, Paramatma means the Supreme Self. And this form of the Lord is the soul of the universe. If we think of the universe as a gigantic organism, so this is the Lord as the soul of the universe and the creator of the universe. As I said, you know, anyone, if their focus is on God, the Supreme Father, God, the Supreme Creator, the Maintainer, the Judge, the Witness, the Friend, but the Friend not in an intimate sense, the Friend as a well-wisher. And that is this understanding of the Absolute, one who knows the Absolute like this. So then there's another manifestation of the Supreme. And there's definitely a minority of religious people and spiritual people who understand this form. So the other two forms, Brahman and Paramatma, are the majority of the people in this world at the present time who say that they're spiritual or religious, or that they worship God, or they worship the Supreme, are worshiping, having some or some connection with the Supreme. It's primarily Brahman or Paramatma. But and one of the most marvelous aspects of the Hare Krishna movement is that our founder, Acharya Srila Prabhupada, brought knowledge of this other manifestation of the Supreme, Bhagavan. So Bhagavan Krishna is God in his complete personality, not just God at work and not just his all-pervading aspect, but his multiplicity of forms, multiplicity of moods, the depth of his personality, all of his sweet dealings with devotees, both in the material world and in his own abode, a full description of his abode. I mean, I think a lot about people who talk about going to heaven, but they're often talking about just a materialistic place that's a lot nicer than this earth. You know, but the Lord's own ultimate heaven, the Lord's own ultimate abode, where not only is the Lord there in his original form and a multiplicity of form, but the souls who are pure in devotion to him are also there in their eternal forms. And there's as many varieties of relationships between the souls and God as there are souls and God. That each soul has an individual relationship, and these can be analyzed as 5 primary relationships and 7 secondary relationships. But really, each soul is very individual in their relationship with loving God. And there's a whole existence, cities and towns and villages and forests and gardens, and which are also all spiritual. The water is spiritual, the buildings, everything is alive, everything is a person, everything is conscious, everything is absorbed, everyone, there isn't really a thing, it's really everyone is absorbed in loving relationships with the Lord. And whatever we experience in this world, every type of relationship, every type of activity, everything has some blissful, perfect parallel in that reality. That this, like Plato talked about being in a cave and just seeing shadows of what was outside. So in this world, all that we're experiencing are shadows or reflections or approximations, replicas of what exists there. Just like, you know, you may buy for your children a toy tool set or a toy kitchen or, you know, a toy car or something like that. And the toy kitchen doesn't really cook anything, and the toy tools don't really fix anything, and the toy car doesn't really go much of anywhere except in circles around the living room. But it's some, like, replica. It's some approximation. So the variety that exists as Bhagavan is unlimited. Unlimited variety, unlimited, always expanding. So this is the 3 ways that one can understand God, and they're all God. They're all God, and they're all not different from each other. And yet, they are different from each other. They're different and not different, absolutely, simultaneously. Now, Prabhupada mentions these 3, and these are the 3 that Srila Prabhupada generally mentions. There is another way of understanding the Absolute Truth, which is given in the Bhagavad Gita, especially in the 11th chapter, but is also described in the 7th, 9th, 10th, and 15th chapter, and is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam, especially in the 2nd canto, the 8th canto, and the 12th canto. And this is a form of God that is manifest and unmanifest. So the Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, they exist eternally, and they're changeless, whereas this other form, it's manifest and unmanifest, and it's constantly changing. And that is the universe itself. So we were saying Paramatma is the soul of the universe, but the Lord is not different from his body. When we say the Lord is a soul and a body, you know, but he is his form. So although the Lord is the soul of the universe as Paramatma, the universe itself as his body is also him. And this universe as the body of the Lord is described, as I said, in great detail in both the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam. Now, nowadays it's become quite common to refer to the ultimate spirituality as the universe. And people will say, you know, well, I want to be in harmony with the universe. Well, you know, the universe responds to your desires. And they speak of the universe as if it is an organic personality, which it is. So that is another way of seeing the Lord. Now, we don't advise seeing the universal form of the Lord as the ultimate form, because, again, it comes and goes. When the universe is created, it's there. When the universe is unmanifested, it's not there. It's constantly changing. And it is not the source of the ultimate bliss that's found in increasing amounts in Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. At the same time, seeing the universe as both Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan, and as the universe, seeing the ultimate truth in all of these ways, is extremely helpful when we are going to consider how to live, which we will talk about also today. So another way we can understand the spiritual is not looking at God, but looking at ourselves, who are a little part of God, as Krishna says in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Mama Ivamso Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana, that we are all a part of God. We are a fragment, but we are an eternal fragment. It's not like, you know, you have a piece of paper and you know, you're going to tear off a piece of your piece of paper. Is this perforated? I think so. You know, you tear off a piece of paper and then it's in little pieces. And then you don't have the whole paper anymore. So it's not like that. It's not like we're part of God, like God got fragmented into little parts and then he's kind of everywhere and he doesn't exist as a whole anymore. It's not exactly like that. We are each complete as parts, but we are still parts. And it's hard to kind of think of a material analogy, maybe a hologram, or maybe the concept of having children, where the children are parts of the parents, and yet they're complete, and the, you know, you don't lose a finger every time you have a baby. You know, it's not like part of you becomes the child, and then that part of you is gone. Those are poor analogies, but they give some concept of something being a part of something else, and yet being a separate individual, and always being a separate individual. Now, in our case, we are eternally, Jiva Bhuta Sanatana, we are eternally a part of the Lord. We are not at any time created. This body is created at some point in the womb of our mother, but we are not created. We are just like the Lord, we are spiritual, we are eternal. And Srila Prabhupada talks about in this purport that we're in this kind of awkward situation. It's definitely an awkward situation having a body, having a mind in this world, being part of this world. So we are spiritual beings. We have an eternal relationship with the Lord. We have an eternal body and mind. We have an eternal persona. So the spiritual tattvavit also, and Prabhupada talks about that in this purport, that when one knows the Supreme, one also knows oneself. Just like if you see the sun, then you also see yourself in the sunlight. So one cannot have self-realization without some degree of God-realization, and one certainly cannot have God-realization without self-realization. So, because when I realize God, I realize myself as a part of God. And if I realize myself as a soul, then I also realize that I am a part of God. So that is what we mean by spiritual. Now, there's some other ways to define spiritual, and I think they're very relevant when we're going to talk about how to live. Srila Prabhupada sometimes says that spiritual means that I am happy at others' happiness and I am distressed at others' distress, that I feel a oneness of interest, a commonality with others. It's compassion, but it's more than that. It's a sense of, again, your happiness is my happiness. I am happy for you. It's love. I mean, it is love. That we care about all other beings, we care about all life, and we find others fascinating and interesting, and we are concerned for the happiness of others. That is also a way of defining the spiritual, a selfless, unconditional love. So let's look at now what is material. So it's very interesting how the Bhagavatam defines material. Krishna says, whatever appears to be of value, if it is without relation to me, it has no reality, know it to be my material energy, that reflection which appears to be in darkness. So basically what material means is seeing things without relationship to the Lord, seeing things differently from what they are. We call this energy Maya. The word Maya is a fascinating word. What do we mean by Maya? But we mean something that appears different from what it is. Now, we all experience this kind of illusion within our daily lives. I hear you say something, and I hear something different from what you said. I hear your words wrong, and sometimes I'll stop and think, is that what they said? Or I'll see something different from what it is. I'll think that there are some people standing on the side of the road, and actually it's a telephone pole and some mailboxes. I see something as something that it is not. We also experience this illusion in pretentiousness when we pretend to be something that we're not. You know, someone says, oh, have you heard about this person? And we go, oh, yeah, I've heard of them. And we're thinking, I have no idea who this person is. Right? Or do you know about this? And, oh, yeah, I know about this. You know, we present ourselves as being smarter than we are or more competent than we are. There's billions and billions and billions of dollars being spent on people trying to look differently than they are. I mean, it's a huge industry. Dyeing one's hair and putting, you know, cosmetics on one's face, or going to the plastic surgeon, or just even buying clothes that make our bodies appear, you know, smaller over here and bigger over there and taller over there and shorter over there, and, you know, trying to have an appearance that's different from what we are. I remember my mother used to sing a song. I don't remember the whole song, but, you know, this lady, before she went to bed, she took off her wig, she took out her eye, she took out her teeth, you know. And then she went to bed quite different from how she presented herself to the world. So we're all experiencing this kind of maya on a regular basis. And almost all of us do this in some way or another, that the presentation we make to others and what is the reality is quite different, right? You know, how are you doing? Oh, I'm fine. And inside we're going, I'm not fine at all. My life is falling apart. You know, and this is, it's quite common. I mean, I recently was dealing with someone who had been injured, and I asked this person, you know, how are you feeling? If you don't move the injured part, how does it feel? And they said, oh, it feels fine. And then I went with this person to the doctor, and the doctor said, how does it feel when you don't move it? And the person said, oh, a 5 out of 10. And I'm like, my God, 5 out of 10. And I'm like, okay, the person was trying to tell me that they weren't in distress when actually they were in distress. So this is, it's just extremely common. People pretending to have more money than they have, buying fake things. And so maya is like that. Maya is, another a really good example in education. So I worked in education for many, many years. And that you put together your educational plan and your educational curriculum. So in the public schools, at least in the government schools, they'll have a big, this thick notebook that they pay some of the teachers to spend months on putting together. What is the curriculum that we're teaching? What is the plan? Etc. And it's, you know, they have it print, they had print like 12 copies with all color and fancy and stuff, and everybody on the school board looks at it, and they, you know, write an article in the local newspaper about it, and then they put it on the shelf and they just go ahead and teach whatever they're going to teach. You know, so they just say, okay, this is what we're doing, and there's some relationship between that and what actually happens in the classroom, but it certainly is not a one-to-one correspondence, right? That we pretending we're doing something other than what we're doing. We're saying we're going to be teaching it like this. And I remember this one school I worked at where they said we do inquiry science, which means that the children come up with the questions and the teachers work at answering them, and the children do a lot of experiments that they design themselves. And I was very impressed. I thought, wow, they do inquiry science. Oh, wow. But that wasn't what they did at all. What they did was buy some pre-made experiment kits, and the teacher would do the experiments, and the kids would just watch, and the kids certainly didn't make up their own questions. But that wasn't obvious right away. You know, it took a couple weeks for me to see, what they say they're doing and what they're actually doing are something different. And such is true at every level, in government, in business, and in the arts. You know, there's a lot of, maya literally means that which is not. So the ultimate illusion, the ultimate pretension, is to see that something has nothing to do with God, to see that something is not connected with the spiritual, to do something, say something, eat something, whatever, interact with something, and deny that this, that whatever it is, whoever it is one is interacting with, is spiritual. To see it as disconnected. That is the ultimate pretension. And an analogy we can give for this is something like, you know, the teenager, they're in their parents' house, they're supported by their parents, they're, you know, doing something that the parents don't want them to do in their parents' house as if it wasn't their parents' house. They're thinking, you know, I hope my parents don't find me doing this in their house. They fail to see the connection between the paraphernalia that they're using, their computer or whatever, and their room and their everything with their parents. So this is how one lives materialistically. A materialist doesn't necessarily mean someone who has 5 cars and 3 big houses. A materialist is somebody who's acting as if everything isn't part of God, as if the universe isn't the body of God, as if God isn't all-pervading everywhere, as if God isn't the soul of the universe, as if God isn't a supreme loving being. And they're perceiving things as if they're disconnected. And Maya means that one wants to perceive things as if they're disconnected, like the rebellious teenagers want to act as if their parents don't really own the house. They want to pretend as if, you know, okay, I can do whatever I want in my parents' house, even things that my parents disapprove of. So that is ultimately material. And another way of defining material is the opposite of love. And the opposite of love, of course, is malice or envy, where I am unhappy at others' happiness, I am happy at others' unhappiness. You know, so much of the news is being happy at others' unhappiness. That this big business person, this big politician has had trouble and everybody rejoices. You know, or this big movie star has had trouble and everybody's rejoicing. So this is a lot of it is like that. You know, we want, in materialistic consciousness, we want others to be happy, but not quite as happy as I am. So it's okay if my neighbor has a nice car as long as it's not as nice as mine. And it's fine if my neighbor has a nice spouse as long as it's not as nice as mine. And it's fine that my neighbor has a smart kid as long as my kid is smarter. So this is, it's envy. And of course, extreme envy is there in things like meat eating, where, you know, I actually want to eat the body of somebody else. You know, I so much want to take from them what is theirs. So that's, you know, theft is envy, that you shouldn't have that, I should have it. And if I can't, if you won't give me what you have, I'll take it from you. Obviously, rape is envy, and meat eating is extreme envy, that I'm going to kill another living being and devour them. I'm going to make them part of me and force them to nourish me by their death. So this is the opposite of spirituality, to see things as disconnected, to see things as what they are not. Pretension, falsity, envy, malice. Now, I said materialism isn't just having a bunch of cars or a bunch of houses or something like that, or having gold jewelry. Although we think of it like that, because often people who have all of those things are people who are also thinking that this world is not part of God, that this world is not spiritual. And they're often thinking in an envious way, but not necessarily. You could be, you know, completely poverty-stricken and be a materialist, and you can be a wealthy person and be a spiritualist. It really depends on one's consciousness and motivation and vision. So how to live? I mean, the verse we have today is looking at tatvavit, one who knows the truth, and one who can see the difference between the material illusion and the truth, and knows how to live. And Srila Prabhupada talks a lot in the purport about knowing how to live. So what does he say in the purport again? He engages himself in the activities of Krishna consciousness, becomes naturally unattached, activities of material senses. He knows that his material condition of life is under the supreme control of the Lord. Consequently, he is not disturbed by all kinds of material reactions, which he considers to be the mercy of the Lord. So Prabhupada talks about a number of ways that when you realize what is spiritual and you realize what is material, even if your realization is intellectual, beginning realization, you start to know how to live. Okay, so we were talking about that materialism or spiritualism is a matter of consciousness. It's a matter of how we view things. At the same time, there are certain activities which are very, very difficult to do in spiritual consciousness. So we mentioned the killing and eating of animals as an ultimate sign of envy. So it's not impossible, but it's almost impossible to eat animals in spiritual consciousness. The killing and eating of animals is so much epitomizes materialism that to do that with spiritual consciousness is almost impossible. I mean, people will say that. They'll say, well, you know, I love you, dear animal, and I'm asking you to die for me. But considering that the vast majority of humans on the planet have access to food other than meat, I mean, unless you're living in the far north and there's simply nothing else to eat, then there's no way it can be a manifestation of love. It must be a manifestation of envy. So therefore, it's just incompatible to say, well, I'm going to eat meat spiritually. And the same is true of exploitive sexual relationships, illicit sexual relationships. It's just, by definition, they're not loving. By definition, they're exploitive. They're the concept that I'm using your body to satisfy my desires. You know, it's not on the basis of love. And therefore, we can also say it's just a spiritual consciousness. Someone in spiritual consciousness doesn't engage in exploitive activities like that. Or intoxication. I mean, intoxication makes you see things differently than they are, even more extreme than somebody in just plain old regular illusion. It becomes an illusion of an illusion. So again, we have a mutual incompatibility between having spiritual consciousness where we see truth and intoxication, which makes you see untruth of untruth. And then we have gambling. So the whole concept of gambling is that I try to get money without an honest exchange of goods or services. Basically, I'm hoping you lose so that I can win. You know, and again, we see the exploitiveness behind that. You know, if I'm doing honest business, then I want the other party also to win, isn't it? Whatever goods or services I'm selling, I'm hoping that the other party is as satisfied as I am. So if you think about, you know, some honest exchange of any kind in any field of work, you want your client, your student, your citizen, your customer, whatever, to be satisfied. And you genuinely want them to be satisfied. Whereas in gambling, you want them to be dissatisfied. You want them to lose. And you could say, well, that's true in sports, but not ultimately. You know, if your other teams always lose, there's nobody to play against. And then you wouldn't have any sports anymore. So that's not really true. And you want everybody to certainly have a good time. But in gambling, the whole idea is exploitive. And it also has an exploitive mentality that I want to become rich easily. I want to get money easily without any kind of honest labor. And therefore, these four activities, meat eating, illicit sex, intoxication, and gambling, trying to have spiritual consciousness and do these activities, it's contradictory. The activities themselves are exploitive or illusory. And therefore, I mean, it's not that the animal's body is illusion. It's part of the Lord's body. It's not that sex is illusion. It's how the Lord has arranged for reproduction and expressions of love between people. It's not that the things that people use for intoxicants are illusory, you know, potatoes that they make vodka out of or whatever. And it's not that that having exchanges of goods and money is illusory. But doing it in those ways pushes us to into an illusory consciousness, pushes us into an exploitive consciousness. And I'm sure there are other things as well, you know, lying and cheating and the kind of things that we think of as sins. They're really things that are so exploitive and are so illusory that they really hinder spiritual consciousness. Now, it's not, again, it's not that there's anything that's separate from the Lord, but there's certain ways of doing things, certain ways of acting that preclude our seeing the connection. However, being material, living a materialistic life and living a spiritual life is not just about, well, I'm going to do these particular activities and not these particular activities. You know, we have our spiritual activities, we have prayer, we have chanting, we have meditation, and so forth, we have worship, that are spiritual activities. But one could do those spiritual activities in materialistic consciousness, and we see this in all the religions of the world, including Gaudiya Vaishnavism, that you could worship the Lord just to impress your neighbors, or, you know, just to have some kind of career as a minister. You could pray just to impress people, you know, whatever. So it's entirely possible to do ostensibly spiritual activities in a materialistic way. So to lead a spiritual life, one should eschew those activities that are intrinsically exploitive. One should try to take up activities that are designed specifically to see the connection of everything with the Lord, like meditation and chanting. And then in our life in general, we practice seeing the Lord in everything and everywhere. And for this, understanding the Lord as the universe is extremely helpful. So those of us who worship the Lord in his ultimate feature of Bhagavan also very much see the universal body of the Lord. We see the trees as the hairs on his body, the clouds as the hair on his head. We see the sun and the moon as his eyes, the earth, the birds as his artistic sense, the wind as his purifier. We're meditating on this kind of thing all the time. That the Lord is the taste of water, the Lord is the ability in man, the intelligence in man. And in this way, we see that everything in the universe is God. We see, it's called Sarvakalam Idam Brahma. We see that everything is spiritual. And this way, in our dealings in the world, we find that connection all of the time. We're constantly making that connection. Oh, here is the Lord's eye, here is the Lord's hair, here is the Lord's bones. Here are the Lord's nails. Here is the Lord's waist, like the bodies of water are his waist. And we have this kind of meditation. And then we do what Prabhupada mentions here in this purport. We dovetail everything. Now the word dovetail, it's an interesting word. It's a way of carpentry. So if you get cheap furniture, then the edges are flush and they're just glued together. Or maybe there's some pegs or something. But if you get higher class furniture, what the edges of the parts are cut in a zigzaggy type fashion, but not exactly zigzaggy. The outcroppings look like the tail of a dove. So it's somewhat triangular, except the edges are flat. And when they fit together, they fit together very securely. It's very difficult to separate two pieces that have been dovetailed. They've been connected with each other. So to dovetail our activities means that whatever we do in this world, from very ordinary things like brushing our teeth and washing our hair and, or extraordinary things, such as our occupation and our work with our family or our charity work. We do this for the pleasure of the Lord. And here we kind of combine this understanding of the universal form of the Lord with the form of the Lord as a Supreme Person, Krishna. So we're saying, you know, okay, here I see as the universal form, you are my ability and you are my intelligence. And this whole body is like a cell within the universe, but I'm doing it for the pleasure of Krishna. I'm brushing my teeth so that Krishna will be pleased with me for taking care of these teeth that he's given me. And I'm driving the car so Krishna will be pleased how I'm taking care of this car that he's given me. So this combination of these two things, dovetailing everything in service. And I really find it very helpful where Krishna talks about in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita what qualities are very dear to him. One who is not envious but who is a kind friend to all living entities, for example. And being kind to others, all living entities, not just other humans and not just other humans who are your friends, but being kind to everyone to please Krishna. That's not that hard. I mean, okay, there are certain times when it's really hard. There are certain times when just being kind to others is really hard. But generally it's not. And to say, well, I'm going to be kind to others just to please Krishna. And then Krishna says things like being unattached to honor and dishonor, fame and infamy, heat and cold. To cultivate a mood of detachment to please Krishna. And we can do that anywhere and at any time. To detach ourselves from an envious, exploitive mentality. And to consciously cultivate actually love and compassion for everything. Then I also found it very significant what Srila Prabhupada said in this purport. He knows that his material condition of life is under the supreme control of the Lord. Consequently, he is not disturbed by all kinds of material reactions, which he considers to be the mercy of the Lord. So to see that whatever happens to me in my life is kindness of the Lord. About a year ago, somebody wrote me that she had had a very disturbing medical situation. And this was somebody who had been really taking excellent care of her health and, you know, doing everything right to be healthy, and just kind of out of the blue ended up having a serious medical condition that she had to deal with. And she said to me, you know, why did this happen? I don't understand. What is the purpose of it? And I said, well, I don't know exactly what the purpose and what the reason was for this specific thing in your life. I said, certainly someday you will know. I said, without any doubt, there'll be a time when you will know exactly and specifically why this thing happened to you at this time. I said, but the general reason for anything that happens to anyone is love. That anything that happens to us is loving, even if it appears to be something difficult, even if it appears to be something very, very painful. The mood behind everything is love. And that's even true for somebody who's working in the laws of karma and is getting the reactions of their karma. Even those laws are designed with a mood of love and designed with a mood of care. And therefore, why should one be disturbed? I mean, we are on this earth planet, as humans on this earth planet, we are not anywhere near the most advanced beings in the universe. You know, in fact, the Bhagavatam tells us that there are 14 levels of planets within the universe, and that we are at the bottom of the middle level. We're kind of like just barely middle class, like we're lower middle class, we just made it over the railroad tracks into the nice part of town, kind of thing. And most of the intelligent living beings in the universe are much, much more intelligent and much, much more capable than we are. So we're not really able, when we have a birth as a human being, we're not really able to understand the wherewithal and the why and how everything works in the universe. We're sort of kind of in the universe like little children. And, you know, little children, if they have good parents, increasingly nowadays, that's not such a common thing perhaps. But if one has good parents, generally speaking, I mean, sometimes the parents may just be tired or upset and they're not thinking of the welfare of their children. But generally speaking, parents are thinking about the welfare of their children. And generally speaking, if the parents say, you know, you can't eat your cookie until you've eaten your broccoli, it's because they love the child. Now, the child may not perceive it like that. The child may perceive it as a lack of love. Or, you know, the parents say to the teenager, you know, you can't go out to this dance with the other kids in your high school. And again, the teenager may see that my parents are repressive and my parents are mean. But the parents are thinking, again, ideally speaking, of the welfare of their children. Now, of course, ordinary parents may not know what's best for their children. And they may, again, have their bad moments and so forth. But when we're coming to the Lord, when we're coming to Krishna, he's not like that. He doesn't have his bad moments. And he's not in ignorance. And he's not selfish. And whatever he arranges for us is definitely for our benefit. Now, of course, I remember seeing a thing once that said, everything has a reason. Sometimes the reason is we're stupid and make bad decisions. So sometimes the reason that we have difficulty in this world is entirely our own doing. But even so, the hand of the Lord is always there. The hand of the Lord is always there. And again, if we're going to look analogously to parents and children, so sometimes parents or teachers, they stand by and allow the child or the student to make a mistake. They won't let them make a mistake that will be seriously harmful to them, but they may allow them to make a mistake, knowing that one of the best ways for the child to learn is to be allowed to make mistakes, and that if you constantly prevent the child from making any mistakes, constantly interfere, that they're not going to learn as well as if you allow it. So the Lord also allows us to make mistakes, and we can say that therefore our difficulties are the result of our own foolishness. At the same time, the Lord is managing all of the reactions and his mood is ultimately loving. And when we see like that, that is also very much part of having a real spiritual life. All right, so we looked at what is spiritual. We looked at Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Brahman is the all-pervading existence. God is all-pervading existence. Paramatma as the Lord is creator, maintainer, the soul of the universe. Bhagavan as Sri Krishna in his divine abode with an infinite amount of forms and relationships. And then we also looked at God as the universal form. We talked about spirituality as being our own self, as the soul separate from the body. And that spirituality also means love. It means love, compassion, connection. It means being happy at others' happiness. And we talked about what is material. That material is pretentiousness. Material is seeing things separate from God, as that which is not. Seeing things in a way that they are not. And materialism is such a feeling of separateness that it leads to envy, it leads to malice, it leads to exploitation. And that spirituality is basically changing, living spiritually, is changing our vision, it's changing our consciousness to seeing the connection. That also includes avoiding activities that are so exploitive in and of themselves, where it's almost impossible to do that activity, such as meat-eating, illicit sex, intoxication, and gambling, and see the connection. And then with the vast majority of activities, it means to see how they're part of the universal body, to dovetail them with pleasing the Lord, to use everything in service, and to see the Lord's hand in every aspect of our life. So I think we'd like to have time for questions, and then you have another kirtan. Yes? Did I do all right with the time?
Atmanirvana Prabhu, we can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Sort of.
Volume should be up.
Yeah, now it's good.
Okay, good. So we finish any time between now and 7, so you're fine. You can take questions and answers, and then, yeah, we usually finish with short kirtan. Thank you. All right.
Okay, so do we have any questions?
Yes, hello?
Yes.
Yes.
What exactly is a Brahma Jyoti?
Brahma Jyoti is another term for the Brahman.
Brahma Jyoti is another term for the Brahman.
I'm hearing an echo.
Okay, thank you.
I'm hearing an echo.
Jyoti just means light.
Jyoti.
So Brahma Jyoti means the light of Brahman.
Thank you, Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, good. So you're describing these four types of activities, which incidentally are in violation of the regular principles: meat eating, gambling, intoxication, illicit sex. As if one does them, you're seeing how this reflects envy. I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more about that, particularly particularly what I'm thinking of is, well, certain of those activities, I'm wondering, like, maybe greed, I don't know, like lust, greed. I know they're all connected to envy.
Yeah, they're there too. They're definitely there too. I mean, gambling is strongly connected with greed. Obviously, illicit sex is strongly connected with lust. And, I mean, it's just a statistical fact that a large number of crimes are committed when a person is intoxicated with various things, which means intoxication increases anger. I mean, some intoxication just makes people very dull, but it still tends to make people not very aware of other people's needs. I mean, it's just common knowledge that people who take intoxication, or we can say that a large number of crimes are committed under the influence of some sort of intoxicant, whether it's, you know, alcohol or cocaine or stuff like that. And obviously there's very mild intoxicants, like caffeine or nicotine, that are not likely to induce you to go rob a jewelry store. But they still distort one's dealings with others. They distort reality. I mean, that's why people take them, because they want to distort reality. If they didn't want to distort reality, they wouldn't take them.
So what's the connection between, say, intoxication done because greed is overwhelming the consciousness, or illicit sex being engaged in because lust is overwhelming the consciousness, for example, and the envy? And I mean, I get the connection, but I'm interested in hearing more from you about how so.
Okay, well, envy is basically the concept that I should have better stuff and a better life and just be better than others. And if somebody else is as good as I am or better than I am, I don't like it. That's like kind of the basic essence of the thing. You know, I might be fine if you're happy, as long as you're not as happy as I am. You know, I need to be better. And envy also involves that if I'm not, I might want you to lose what you have, or I might want to take it away from you. It's, you know, I don't want you to have something, or I want to take it from you. I consider that what you have belongs to me. It's the opposite of love, where I share your happiness, and if you supersede me in something, I'm genuinely happy for you. I feel that your happiness and your accomplishments and your wonderfulness are glorious. So in all of these, there's some degree of taking. I mean, we talked about how in meat eating, I'm actually taking the body of the animal and eating it. I see that as kind of the nth degree of envy. I'm taking your body from you. I'm destroying your ability to use your body for anything. I throw you out of your body. You know, it's like as I just go to your apartment and I throw you out and I just take over the apartment, or carjacking, you know, I just throw you out of your car and I just take it for myself. And gambling is like that. Of course, it's by agreement. The animal doesn't agree, but in gambling, you agree because you're trying to exploit me as much as I'm trying to exploit you. So you're hoping I'll lose all of my money and it will become yours, and I'm hoping you'll lose all of your money and it will become mine. And in intoxication, I often see myself as better than I am. Isn't it? I mean, even something very mild like caffeine, where I imagine that I'm smarter and more alert and more competent than I am, isn't it? Isn't that why people take caffeine? Whether it's in, you know, soda or coffee or energy drinks or however much they take it, so they can have a pretense of being more competent than they are or more calm than they are, you know, or more detached than they are. You know, people will take marijuana so they can pretend that they're very detached.
Well, I don't care what's happening. Everything's fine with me.
Well, that's not really how they feel. But under the influence of the intoxicant, they pretend that they're very renounced. So they pretend that they're competent or something. You know, it's a pretense where I'm artificially taking on qualities that are not mine. And illicit sex means that I'm wanting to enjoy others' bodies without a commitment of love and care. I'm just, you know, enjoying your body for my pleasure, and, you know, maybe I'll give you pleasure in return, less like in gambling, I'm giving you the chance to take my money. But there is not, it's not a concern. You know, in proper sexual relationship, we're sharing our lives together. We don't just share our physical bodies, we share our lives. Sharing the physical body is part of a sharing of life, and hopefully a creation of life. Whereas in illicit sex, you don't want to create life. And if people are really into illicit sex, then a lot of what they share is disease. So it's, you know, it's interesting that sexual relations release various chemicals in the brain. And these are chemicals of feelings of attachment and feelings of love. And my own conviction is that Krishna's designed our bodies that way because by nature's way, sex results in babies, generally speaking. Just like healthy food results in nourishment. You know, if you want to eat and eat and eat and eat and eat and eat and not get fat, then you eat food that has no calories. The whole purpose of food is calories. That's the purpose of food, that it's like you want to put gas in your car that has octane, you know. If you put in gasoline that has no octane, your car is not going to go anywhere. So if you put in food that has no calories, your calories is what your body burns for heat and for energy. So, you know, let me eat a ton of food that's calorie free so I can think that I'm eating and not actually eat. So illicit sex is very much like that. That people want, they want the pleasure of eating without the calories. So they want the pleasure of sex without responsibility, without love, without caring, without producing life, without really producing a connection with another being. But these chemicals that are naturally produced in the act of sex, they're designed because sex is designed to produce a child, like food is designed to nourish the body. And Krishna wants that people who produce the child love each other and are attached to each other, because human babies take a really long time to mature. And it's a lot, and it's hard to raise human babies. It's hard to raise them if only one parent is around. Ask any single parent. It's really hard. And so ideally there's two parents who love each other and love the child. And that's what these chemicals are there. That's what they're for. This sense of increasing the love and attachment between the sexual partners. That's how nature has designed us. So if you try to have sex without that, it ends up being harmful. You know, you're releasing these chemicals of love and attachment, but there is no love and there is no attachment. It's just a business exchange. And such is harming, it harms oneself and it harms the other party. And it may be a subtle emotional harm that's not so easily discernible, but it is definitely there. And you see that people who go through a lot of uncommitted illicit relationships, it's easy for such people to become hardened. I mean, plus there's havoc in society in general. You know, sex is meant to be part of a stable societal structure. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
Any other questions?
We had a comment on YouTube, like Andrea from Gainesville, most people here know her, she left a comment on YouTube. So that, thank you for sharing the story of your former student in a coma. I always wondered what the sacred texts say about comas or even people on life support.
Well, Srila Prabhupada said that when a person is in a coma that leads to death, that the higher beings in the universe, the celestial beings in the universe, are debating where they should go. It isn't clear. So that's what he says, is why some people are in a coma that leads to death. They're destined to die, but there's not an agreement between the higher beings as to where they should go and what should happen to them. I don't know of any, as far as people who are in comas and then recover, I think you have that kind of question has probably as many answers as there are people as to why. And we know that when people recover from comas, they recover in all degrees of functionality. So it depends how long they're in a coma. And I mean, this former student of mine who was in a coma for 2 months seems to be fully mentally functional, and she's gradually regaining physical functionality. There can be all kinds and degrees of loss of functionality. I mean, it's so individual. And I think that's like asking, you know, what is the karmic basis of cancer or something like that. There's as many answers as there are people. It isn't a one answer. I mean, if you say, you know, anyone who's in jail for 2 years, what did they do? Well, they did a wide variety of crimes to be in jail for 2 years. It's not that everyone who's in jail for 2 years has done exactly the same crime. And even two people who've done similar crimes may have done them. There's still maybe wide variances in what they did. And the same with piety. As far as life support, I mean, Srila Prabhupada says that the duration of our life, generally speaking, is fixed from our behavior in our previous life. So, again, that's generally speaking. It's not an absolute, but generally. So you really cannot artificially prolong somebody's life. What you can do is you can increase or decrease some of the suffering. And as far as individuals, as to whether or not they want this or that medical procedure, that is such an individual thing. That's such an individual decision. I mean, I don't know of anything in the scriptures that would say, okay, it should be like this. And, I mean, just reasonably speaking, somebody might feel very differently about that when they're 22 as when they're 82. And what kind of general medical conditions they have and what's going on in their life. I mean, I know of someone who's in his 40s. He was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer when he was 31. And he went through extensive chemo and radiation and all kinds of treatments. He's had 4 or 5 relapses. He basically has to take chemo every day for the rest of his life. And the treatment itself has caused, of course, many other side effects and medical conditions. The treatment itself has given him diabetes, and he has an insulin pump, and so many things. And, you know, I might look at that and say, wow, you know, better to just say, let me die from the cancer. But, you know, he was a fairly young man with a young wife and young children, and he felt he would rather take these medical things and continue on. So that's a really, what an individual decision. And I don't see that one person can say what should be done, or that that's necessarily a spiritual question. The question in terms of spirituality is, to what extent am I connecting everything with the Lord, whether I'm on life support or I'm not on life support? To what extent am I connecting my thoughts, my body, my consciousness, my emotions with the Lord, and seeing His hand in everything? And how that plays out in your life and in my life is going to be quite different. Do we have any other questions?
And another comment Andrea left. It's like so helpful to understand the regulative principles from the space of spiritual mindset or basis of love. How activities are contradictory to try spiritual and love mindset.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. So you want to have a little kirtan now? Maybe someone else can lead?